It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
You are licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
This man ate till he burst.
So he did die by eating.
Lunch Hour Reviews.
I'm tainting me.
Tainting me!
It's feeding time.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rance Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rance Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
Welcome back, listeners, to part two of our American Horror Story
Freak Show
series. Last episode, you should probably listen to that first if you haven't gotten there. Part one, we talked about the very first episode and all the influences that mm-hmm. went into it in terms of the real life people who actually experienced this throughout the era of freak shows, and also the movie Todd Browning's 1932 cult classic.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. Freaks. So we're coming back with descriptions of the episodes and sort of the broader story arcs. We're not going to get too spoiler crazy because there's a lot of additional content to cover.
Going through and like rewatching it, I realized how many stories are going on at one particular time.
Yeah.
It didn't really occur to me. I think the first time I watched it, I really assumed that like Bette and Dot were the most important characters.
Yeah.
But like watching it again, I see so much more with Paul and different characters. So watching it again was actually really great.
I really enjoyed that as the season goes, you do get everybody's backstory. You mm-hmm. do get these, you know, very human stories that led everybody to this, you know, traveling freak show in Jupiter, Florida in 1952.
The town of Jupiter is in the grips of terror for a second week from four unsolved murders and a child who remains missing. Schools stand like mausoleums. Their attendance drastically declined as parents keep their children safely home. And we have learned, though this report has not yet been confirmed, that one of their own, possibly a Jupiter police detective, has himself been missing for 2 days. Reliable sources in the police department have circulated the clarion cry that, quote, no stone will be left unturned. The boys in blue are out for blood.
So at the end of the first episode of this season, we have a dead cop on circus grounds. Although it's 1952, they're not, you know, they don't know that the cop was necessarily there. They just know that the cop was missing.
Right.
But now we know that the collective freaks have this secret that they are, you know, trying their best to keep and trying to keep under lid.
Three titties. Proper girl paws and a ding-a-ling. I'm a full-blown hermaphrodite. Put that on your banner.
My word. What does that make you?
The happiest man on earth.
Enter Del Toledo and his wife Desiree,
yeah.
played by Angela Bassett. Del Toledo is Michael Chiklis, or the Commish.
Yeah, I just call him the Commish.
People have seen The Shield, I guess, more than the Commish. But in any case, Michael Chiklis, he's a short, stout, bald guy. He's imposing, and in this, he's kind of nasty.
He
sells himself as
real
like an enforcer.
Asshole. Yeah, because he is the strong man, and that appears to be all he really kind of has going for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's great about him is very much like Superman, where he can look normal, but he has to be secretly Superman. Del is outwardly normal, except for being this strong man, so he can go anywhere he wants to and fit in. However, inside, and he keeps it a very big secret in 1952, he is a closeted gay man.
What a freak.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of interesting that he can walk around and do all these things and appear normal on the outside, but inside he has this secret where he views himself as a freak.
I guess by now it's almost like a classic overcompensating kind of machismo, where he's just like the imposing alpha male, but deep down, well, so Desiree, played by Angela Bassett, is tri-boobed.
Yes.
And I missed it on the first pass, but it was only this last time around that I realized that they were also pushing the sort of hermaphroditic mm-hmm. element. And so this is a little bit of a throwback to the movie Freaks, where they had the half man, half woman as they were selling he and her. But because of the times, they could only show it through clothing and like hairstyle.
Well, that's what I wondered is like, how are you selling this? You have, so say you have this person in your show and it's 1912. How are you proving that this is this? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. New show? I don't know.
You take your word for it. Supposedly, a lot of people who were billed as the bearded woman was just a guy in drag.
That makes sense.
So it seems like the public will give it quite the benefit of the doubt. We didn't talk about him in the first episode, I don't think very much, but in the second episode, he's more prominent. Paul, the, quote, illustrated seal,
right,
which is a curious title.
My name is Matt Fraser, and I play Paul, the illustrated seal. This condition is called phocomelia, and it means seal-like limbs. In my case, it was induced by my mother taking the morning sickness pill, thalidomide. Thalidomide is a really powerful and good painkiller. You just shouldn't take it when you're pregnant. A woman would take it in vitro around the 30th day of pregnancy to avoid morning sickness. It stopped the nerve buds for the limbs forming, which then in turn stopped the limbs forming. After 15 years of exploring it, freak means a radically different person on stage entertaining with their radical difference. I cannot but help exploit my physique when I'm performing. I think what's interesting about me is my personality. Of course, these are different and they're interesting to look at, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm powerful and awesome, and I have these, and I'm a freak, and I'm an actor, and I'm a freak actor playing a freak, and it's awesome.
Matt Fraser is an actor. He's like a accomplished martial artist.
Yes, he
and
is.
And in the show, we get to watch him drum, and it's not a coincidence that it looks perfect. He's a drummer.
He is a drummer. He's a musician.
He's a performance artist. So, like, really interesting guy, and very, I mean, the accent goes a long way. He's very charming.
He's very charming. We see his character in episode 6 in Bullseye is actually kind of having a relationship with Elsa.
Yeah.
And then we see he's actually having an affair on the side with Mamie Gummer, who is Glenn Close's daughter, by the way.
Ah, okay.
And she's a quote-unquote, like,
Normie.
Yeah, is that I don't know. Is that a thing? So, I mean, you can kind of see those guys, like, really, really handsome. And now he's got two ladies going
Matt
on.
Matt Fraser worked, I didn't want to let it go by, but he worked here in New York at the Coney Island Freak Show.
Oh,
like,
wow.
He's traveled and he's done the rounds. And he's someone who's very vocal about, like, the empowerment of really embracing your oddity, I suppose. And when it comes to exploiting it, just, like, you be the boss.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Snails. How boring.
That's what you ordered, escargot, like you had in Paris.
Daro went to a lot of trouble. Don't you make a sour face.
That boy's working my last nerve.
In the second episode, we have Finn Wittrock's character and his mother, Frances Conroy. And I loved them. And I loved them the first time I watched the show. I loved it even more this time. You didn't, but whatever.
The first time around, I really loathed his character. Frances Conroy is fascinating, though.
I think the two of them together are so great. And in this episode, Dandy is he's just bitching about how bored he
you
is.
You said it quickly. His name is Dandy.
His name is Dandy.
It's literally Dandy. He's like a rich kid
named
Dandy.
He's a fancy lad. The two of them together have the most odd, fucked up relationship that two people can have.
It is enabling and codependent at the same time.
Exactly.
Like, he is unsocialized. He has no friends. He has a giant room.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother. And that is very much what's going on.
Yeah, no, this is like the, active, proactive Norman Bates, but like, Norman Bates' mom didn't even like him that much. Well, I guess if you're going by the show, she did.
I mean, clearly you can tell this kid is fucked up. He's already been caught, like, killing a lot of the animals in the neighborhood, things like that. Patti LaBelle seems to know what's going on, but he's so bored, Dandy is, that Frances Conroy sees Twisty the clown on the street, who Twisty looks like a goddamn maniac.
Yeah.
He's filthy.
We already know he's a murderer.
Exactly. Frances Conroy says, you know what, I'm going to pick up that guy and put him in my car and give him to my son.
Dandy loves clowns.
He does love clowns. And so he's gifted Twisty in this particular episode.
Yeah, and it becomes a very curious, like, almost, like, protege kind of position, especially when Dandy realizes that, like, oh, this guy is, like, terrifically twisted, not unlike myself.
Exactly. He sees a little bit of himself in there.
Episode 3 is called Edward Mondrake, because this is when they bring in Wes Bentley's character. Thankfully, late.
Yeah.
But it is on Halloween, and I couldn't find whether or not it's actual tradition amongst freak shows to not perform on Halloween.
I don't think so, because there's tons of flyers of vaudeville performing on Halloween.
Yeah, it would be like passing up the best day of the year.
Of course. So yeah. I don't really know that that's a thing. But Edward Mordrake is, however, a totally false thing. Because I scoured so many things looking for a man with a face on the back of his head. I went through so many, like, anatomical, like, book things that I could find. It was another terrifying episode of Mindy Goes to the Library and Searches for a Man with a Face on the Back of His Head. Doesn't exist, you guys. So lame.
Okay, so before Mordrake shows up, we do get Maggie Esmeralda, played by Emma Roberts, who she's a fortune teller. What she is like a 19-year-old blonde manic pixie dream girl in 1952. It's just, I don't know, as a normie, she is the least interesting character to be in this entire...
She is even less so than Mordrake.
And again, we talked about the idea of a gaffed person, like someone who is affecting a character to fit in. And she's doing a very rudimentary, like, cold read. It's like, I've had fortune cookies that were more accurate than that.
Right,
like,
right.
It's just, ugh. But, okay, so she's followed by Stanley, who is far more interesting.
Sir, bother you folks. I was hoping to buy a ticket to the show, but it seems to be sold out. I'm here from out of town. Yeah. Hollywood, California is where I call home.
Hollywood?
Richard Spencer. Talent scout.
I think we can find you a seat.
Dennis O'Hare, who we talked about in our last series,
is
playing
a huge
Liz
scumbag.
Taylor. Well, in
this, not Liz Taylor.
Here he's a con man, but most interestingly, he's working on behalf of the Museum of Morbid Curiosities.
Right.
The medical community has always been fascinated by freaks of nature. They highlight the strange wonders of the human body and illuminate the horrors of disease and disorder, death. For these poor souls, Halloween must have come as a great relief. The one ordained day they were allowed to hide behind costumes. Here at the American Morbidity Museum, we not only embrace their differences, we celebrate them.
So the two of them are coming from Philly, although Stanley is sort of keeping his background hidden because he's in for the long con. But the Museum of Morbid Curiosities is based on the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia.
Right.
Come one, come all, to the marvelous Mutter Museum. Established in 1863 by Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter as part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia as an early center for medical education. Now located in 19 South 22nd Street in downtown Philadelphia, the museum is host to over 20,000 specimens and displays. But perhaps you should go on an empty stomach, as the Mutter Museum is home to over 1,500 wet specimens, including cysts, tumors, and other pathology from all parts of the body. Among them, a malignant tumor removed from President Grover Cleveland's jaw, and the shared liver from Chang and Eng, the famous Siamese twins, and even slides of Albert Einstein's brain. Eat Your Heart Out Bodies exhibit, the Mutter has over 3,000 skeletal specimens, including the tallest skeleton on exhibit in North America, standing at 7 foot 6 inches tall. Open every day from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with $2 off every Monday and Tuesday. So brace yourselves and join us in downtown Philadelphia for the one, the only, Mutter Museum.
So I think in the show, they push it more to the idea that this is a high social museum with a lot of clout, power, and money.
Yes, it seems to be very fancy, a very fancy ordeal.
And they'll make it worth your while if you can collect, say, a two-headed lady.
Yes.
Or lobster hands from a lobster boy or the world's smallest woman.
Exactly.
And so this is Stanley's motivation. He is a man without a conscience, seemingly without a soul, because he only looks at people for what he can get out of
them.
Right,
exactly.
it's a nice change of pace for Dennis O'Hare to go from this to Elizabeth Taylor, who is like far more glowing a person.
Yeah.
And far always, more empathetic.
Previously, Dennis O'Hare kind of always plays scumbag on the, you know, in this show.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking of him in the sort of not remake, but follow up to The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah.
As the son of the filmmaker. Like, he plays a, like, a textured douchebag. Like, he's a creep.
Yeah. He's really good at it. That's the way I think Liz Taylor in Hotel is just so great, because it's like you've never seen Dennis O'Hare like that.
He transforms, yeah.
Yeah. So we are taught this particular superstition that in freak shows you don't perform on Halloween night, or else bad shit happens. And then we find out, what is this bad shit? Well, Ethel's going to tell you in that ridiculous accent. And she proceeds to tell everybody about Edward Mordrake, the man with one face, like a normal face on the front, and then a secret evil face on the back that whispers evil, scary shit to him. It's like the weirdest, stupidest thing ever. After I discovered it wasn't real, I was like so disappointed and annoyed with this whole story.
Yeah, it's kind of a weak device. It was a device to get a lot of characters' backstories in a single episode. And so those moments are great.
It's played by Wes Bentley. He's fucking terrible. And he now travels with this group of ghost freak people, too.
Yeah, his, like, dead menagerie.
And he chooses the best freak on Halloween who performs, and now that person lives in his menagerie of people.
Is he? I'm trying to remember if he's grabbing like the worst of the worst in terms of like sins.
Yeah, yeah, he's looking for the worst of the worst. And so he has to interview every single person and figure out what's so bad about them.
So we get Elsa's background. In the end of the first episode, we do reveal that she is an amputee. She has her legs, I think, just below the knees. She's got... And we've got this really dark backstory of Germany in the 1920s and how she kind of ran the gamut of everything from, like, show woman and singer to, like, porn star and BDSM dominatrix.
Yeah.
In this flashback, we do get the full picture of, like, the gory details of what happened, and we're introduced to a character we've already met.
Right. We see from Asylum, from my most favorite season. Yeah. So anything from Asylum that shows up in another episode is,
like Pepper.
My Easter egg for me. Yeah. This is James Cromwell playing same character, Dr. Arden, and we know from Asylum...
We know he's a sadist.
He
we know
not
he's
a good guy.
A mad scientist, and... In their, like, BDSM slash, well, in this case, it's more akin to a snuff film.
Mm-hmm.
They saw off her legs on camera.
Yeah.
And this like, probably 8mm film makes it out into the world, and there are later repercussions. But it is, like, a really grisly look back.
Really, you know, and I oftentimes am talking about Berlin, because Berlin in the 30s was insane. It was just a really... crazy place. So this is so believable to think that snuff films like this were existing in Berlin. I'm kind of sure it was.
I would imagine, like, off-duty Nazi officers, I could definitely see some sick shit like this happening. I did want to mention the idea that Elsa is pretty closely based on Marlene Dietrich.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of today listening and watching, like, documentary pieces on her. I didn't know anything about her besides the name and, like, old Hollywood. But she's fascinating. As well as being the influence for Elsa, I think there was also an element where she's probably the inspiration for Diane Kruger's character in Inglourious Basterds, Bridget von Hammersmark, in terms of this double agent. Like, she's German-born, mm-hmm. but she's working with the Allies. But Marlene Dietrich, not exactly James Bond, but she did a ton of USO work. And so, sorry, her career started where in the 20s she was a silent film actress, she was a singer, she was a show woman. She was risque and in this time that sort of accommodated someone who was, you know, sort of on the fringes of society.
Right.
She's dressing like a man. She's making out with song girls on stage. Like, she is daring. And, you know, someone obviously thinks that, like, she's got show-stopping power and puts her in the movies. She was in a number of movies, including Hitchcock's Stage Fright. She was known as having those bedroom eyes, which sounds like eyes with intention.
Yeah, bedroom eyes to me sounds like sleepy eyes with just makeup all over them. let me tell you, my bedroom eyes are not attractive.
And she's also described as having legs for days, which is almost ironic that Elsa's character is denied that.
Right. And Elsa, in this particular story, is obsessed with Marlene Dietrich.
Yeah.
And she even has this scrapbook kind of like showing where their careers parted paths, her compared to Marlene.
Yeah, because Marlene Dietrich never stopped working, it seemed. Like, even after, you know, Hollywood kind of kicked her out for, God forbid, getting old, she was still on the road traveling. Yeah. She was doing cabaret shows. She had, like, a series of standards. And the aesthetic, like, a number of images are her dressed in a tux. And Elsa clearly takes that influence to the next level. Like, she's dressed in the same way. Among the people whose backstory we get Legless Susie.
My name is Rose Siggins, and I play Legless Susie. When I was born, I was diagnosed with sacrilegenesis. I did have legs, but my legs were useless. They kind of just dangled there. It was either be confined to a wheelchair or possibly have them amputated. So let's do the amputation, and that's what they did when I was two. In the 70s, when I was born, the medical idea was, if it doesn't work, take it away. And now today we find out, if it doesn't work, keep it. You know, I don't know. I kind of like the way I am. I would never change it. I couldn't imagine myself being, I guess, what everybody called normal, because this is my normal. Legless Susie is a very scared and frightened person. I could not imagine people treating you so poorly because of how you looked. Once you remove the legs, which is considered three quarters of the body, mentally you start thinking of yourself as, I'm not a whole person. So of course she would have joined a circus too, because that was family.
She's reminiscent of the half-boy from the movie Freaks, played by Johnny Ek, and she gets around incredibly well. She's, you know, moving around on her hands. I thought it was interesting that Johnny Ek wears gloves. Not Legless Susie. She's too tough for that. She's just bare-handing it on fairgrounds.
Yeah, that's surprising. Like, that, after I think all that weight on your hands would just be, like, a really killer, but she must be
you build up calluses.
Tough lady.
Yeah, I mean, talk about tough. She had two kids, and she describes as them going, like, smoothly without complication. We did find out that, sadly, she died last year from complications of a surgery. Also, in the first episode, we're introduced to Meep, who is doing a couple things. But the actor Ben Wolfe is playing Meek, who is sort of playing the role of the geek, which is someone who eats things in the tradition of freak shows. They would eat living things.
Right.
We watch him eat a chicken head, like, for breakfast in that first episode.
Yeah, he's just kind of something that he does.
In behind-the-scenes stuff, Ben Wolfe talks about how he was a preschool teacher. He's suffering from pituitary dwarfism, so he stopped developing after he was treated for cancer, and it affected his pituitary, and he didn't continue to grow. Sadly, he also died.
He did, and that was very tragic, you know? It's like bad, bad luck on American Horror Story Freak Show.
Yeah. We're rejoined with Twisty and Dandy just kind of doing what they do, kidnapping people, scaring the shit out of them with, like, children's shows.
It's pretty terrifying, because Dandy is basically, once Twisty wanders off the bus, Dandy's like, these are mine now, and I'm going to babysit them to the best of my abilities.
Yeah, yeah. So horrifying all the same, and then Mordrake, I always wanted to say Mandrake, but Mordrake shows up and kind of demands Twisty's story, and so this is the first time he takes off the mask.
Yeah, and we hear a great John Carroll Lynch monologue. And it's so sad. I just love that man's monologues. They're so good. But this one's so sad because this is a man who just wanted to be a clown. Pretty simple fella. But he's getting bullied by these two, a group of dwarves from the circus that he's currently working in.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a big hit with the kids. And
yeah, they were jealous. Seeming
that, yeah. And this is actually a correction I have to make from last episode, that I started confusing the movie Freaks with Twisty's backstory, and so that's just a correction. So in this backstory, we get, like, the full tragedy that amounts to Twisty, who, you know, so far we know him as a killer clown. He's seemingly a little, like, thoughtless compared to, say, like, John Wayne Gacy, who dressed like a clown and killed children. Twisty is childlike himself, and his disfigurement, like, I guess it's just like the physical manifestation of like he is broken. He is a broken man, and that he did this to himself after like hitting bottom is it's just tragedy wrapped in tragedy.
Yeah, and I don't want to spoil things because it's a great reveal. It's a great story to hear. But he kind of thinks in some ways that he's doing the right thing by saving these kids from thoughtless parents, things like that. It's so sad. But he's the big winner, and Mordred comes and gets him.
So that's the sort of outro for Twisty, who we thought was going to be bigger throughout the season, but that's kind of it.
But we get his story, and that's it. Now he's gone on to bigger and better things.
So throughout this episode, Jimmy and Maggie are kind of like in this burgeoning love affair, figuring each other out, and they encounter this like horrifying campfire terror show for children, and eventually like some chase down, and they draw attention to the cops, and it becomes apparent that that is the killer who's been on the loose. It's the reason that they've had a curfew. And thankfully now there's public support for Jimmy.
Because it looks like they saved the day. The freaks saved the day, even though it was Mordrake, whatever. And Twisty is now out of the picture. So at the end of this episode, we have the community coming in and saying thank you for saving our community.
Yeah, I think it's the one time, aside from, say, like, fans of Jimmy who enjoy his bedroom.
But they pretend like they don't know him later.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, this is the only time the people of the town are actually welcoming when the freaks are doing them favors by catching criminal killers.
The next episode is Pink Cupcakes, and lots of shit goes down in this episode. So many things go down. And we're introduced, though, with Stanley taking Bette and Dot to a picnic.
Yeah, and we get this sort of ominous flash forward, I suppose, at the museum. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking all the same. But yeah, at the moment he shows any generosity or niceness, the viewer should know that, like, he has the worst intentions.
Always the worst intentions.
But so I like that it's Bette, right, that refuses the cupcake?
Yes.
And so, yeah, her spider sense is tingling. She is the skeptic of the two of them.
Right, but I would take that cupcake. I think you could really easily trick me with cupcakes.
They were delicious looking.
They
pink
looked
frosting.
Really good.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of his ploy. It's got to look like you can't pass it up.
No.
And yeah, I don't know. It was 1952. I'd imagine like a fantastic looking cupcake. These days, you got fancy cupcake stores on every corner.
Right, right. But that was probably something spectacular. And I would be fooled even today. I'd be fooled by that. So if you want to poison me, give me a cupcake.
I think this is the first time that we see Elsa take the stage and sing. And at this point, they've heralded the twins. This sort of double-headed character is what the town is hoping to see. And that Elsa makes a show about her, they don't react so well.
No.
And so we have, she barely gets to finish her David Bowie song.
And even watching this is actually the second time we hear Life on Mars. She's done it in a rehearsal once before, and we heard it, and it was spectacular, and there was all this fantasy. This time is just, like, lame. I was even annoyed, like, watching it, like, I've heard this before. I've heard this. She's treated us to the Lana Del Rey song in previous episodes, and now we're hearing Life on Mars again, and I don't want to hear it again.
I love it. Although, well, I don't know. But I did want to point out that we get three David Bowie songs throughout the series. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of love – I mean, it's – I love David Bowie. It was especially painful in January of this year, whenever the listener is hearing this. It was 2016 and January 10th, we lost David Bowie. And from the very beginning, he was someone who – like, without having to spell it out, was all about, like, letting your freak flag fly.
Right.
Here was this, like, androgynous English kid with an injury to his eyes, so he's always dilated, and he seemingly got two different colored eyes. And his music is some of the most, like, creative and fascinating that it suits the show incredibly well. And I like that. The show has, like, these elements of 1952, but the music is modern.
Right, right.
In Pink Cupcakes, this episode, we get more backstory for Desiree.
Yeah.
And Ethel's had some health issues that she needed a doctor for, and it's the same doctor that she brings Desiree to, mm-hmm. who, upon inspection, tells her that, like, you are not a hermaphrodite. You're all woman, lady.
Yeah.
And if you're obsessed about the aesthetic, we could address that medically, which I heard that, and I was just like, don't do that. Like, I'm sure sensitivity is going to go down a lot.
I don't know. But otherwise, this doctor, though, he can make her a quote-unquote normal lady.
Yeah. And
he
so
remove
she...
remove one of the boobs.
She's excited about, like, being a mom. She comes right. back to Del with this news, and he's just like, fuck no. Yeah. He's just a fucking ball of negativity and, like, just ruinous loathing, this guy.
So Del, in this one, we're reintroduced to Matt Bomer, who's been kind of dating Del, and Matt Bomer works in this bar, and he's seemingly a hustler. And him and Del have this relationship where Del's a real asshole and Matt Bomer puts up with it for some reason that we can't quite figure out.
Takes all kinds.
But unfortunately for Matt Bomer, Dandy comes to the bar this time. At the end of this episode, we have Elsa being, again, really jealous of the twins, sees them with Stanley, and then because Stanley is promising Elsa certain things, and so now Elsa's jealousy is super peaked. She takes the twins and delivers them right on the doorstep to Dandy and Frances Conroy.
Dandy made an offer pretty early to purchase the twins. Again, I guess it happened. You said Cuckoo the Bird Girl was essentially in that same sort of slave scenario where she was sold from her family, and they, you know, Elsa's perfectly willing to do this to the, you know, her competitor for the limelight, the twins. And so, they come into the possession of Dandy. Episode 6 is called Bullseye, and we get an early look that Elsa has been in the show business for long enough that she's got a pretty wide array of skills.
She has more skills than you think that she has.
And pretty useful for what it turns out. But the old knife throwing at a person, in this case, on a spinning wheel, as if you really needed
to jazz
that up. But it's terrifying. I don't know. Jessica Lange does it really well, so it's convincing. And as far as special effects, it's flawless.
Yeah.
She's just throwing knives. So if the show wasn't, in her mind, all about Elsa to begin with, it is her birthday on this episode. And so she kind of demands on this one day. I think people generally fawned over her to begin with.
Yeah.
So asking more seemed like really gratuitous and awful of her to like
this
impose upon.
This is the episode that you really, like, you spend the entire season hating and feeling sorry for her.
Yeah.
And this is one of those episodes is probably the most that you feel both ways about her so strongly.
Yeah.
And I think it's really apparent when her birthday does not go the way as she wants it to go. And she yells at everybody, including yelling at the pinheads. And it's so mean. Mm-hmm. It's just not nice. And she's mad at Paul because she knows that Paul is having this affair. So in an effort to tell them to, like, prove their loyalty, they put Paul up on the thing.
This is the episode where I really grew to loathe Maggie Esmeralda.
If you didn't, like, loathe her already, which I totally did.
Well, up to this point, we haven't actually seen her, like, commit atrocities or even show what she's capable of or willing to do.
I don't know. For me, she's like a Lady West Bentley.
Really?
Yeah. Emma Roberts. Lady West Bentley. So to me, I'm just not interested in any part of what's going on.
So the point where she crosses the line is her and Stanley are there for the purposes of exploiting this group. And in this case, she has her eyes on Ma Petite.
Yeah.
And, like, enough so that this glass case that is going to be filled with formaldehyde, like, they brought it with them. Like, they're not even, like, killing her and shipping her in a box. Like, they're going to do it on site. And it's,
they're essentially going to drown her in this.
Yeah, it's a fucking terrifying scene. And because Ma Petite, who, just a couple words on Jyoti Amge, actually was in the news a couple years before this season.
Because I had seen her before.
Yeah, and she was the world's smallest woman. She's born in India. And it's funny, we were talking about her earlier, and she speaks English pretty well in the show.
Really? Yeah, really well.
But it's all learned. Like, she wasn't raised speaking English. So, you know, she's, as it turns out, a great actress.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And when she is in the tank and she is childlike, I think they kind of work with her in terms of having her character be kind of childlike and the least cynical person in the world, because when Emma Roberts sort of convinces her to get in the tank, she has her pretend like it's like you're a butterfly.
Like you're a butterfly in a case. And then she's doing the most adorable butterfly things. And you just, this is one of those characters similar to the Pinheads where you're just, they're just purely good people.
Yeah.
When shit happens to these purely good characters, you get infuriated.
Yeah. Yeah. And so thankfully, in that instance, it doesn't work out. But that Esmeralda was willing to like drown alive a human being in front of her is fucking monstrous.
Yeah, she sucks. Boo. Episode 7, Test of Strength, is where Jimmy now goes ahead to go to Dandy's mansion and get the twins back because now he knows where they are.
Figured it out, yeah.
And they tell him, oh no, the twins are here because they want to be here. Except for he takes the twins back and now everyone's back now home at the freak show.
Yeah, at this point, they've had a long enough time with Dandy that like, they got to get the fuck away from that guy.
Yeah, and the biggest thing that kind of pissed them off was that Dandy read their diary.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's such a childish thing, which reminds me of, like, Family Guy when they're always reading Meg's diary for fun. and it just, like, pisses her off. So it's such a childlike thing to be pissed off at someone reading your diary.
So Paul is still recovering from his fucking knife to the stomach.
Terrible knife wound.
And I guess Penny is there because, you know, their love is legitimately both ways. And we get a look at what Penny has to come home to and her fucking vicious dad who's not having any part of her dating a freak.
No.
And I'm going back for good. I just came home to pack. You're going to have to kill me to stop me.
You think I wouldn't?
I'm your only child, the only record of your sorry life once you're gone. You're too vain to picture a world without a piece of you in it.
I think you mistake my pride for vanity. I'm an electrician. Strangers welcome me into their homes and leave me there alone to ply my trade. A man like me is dead if it doesn't come with a sterling reputation. You are my blood. But if you do something to shame me, to shame this family, I will do whatever it takes to make sure no one ever knows you belong to me.
Well, prepare for the shaming of your life. Because I am in love with Paul. And I'm going to go live with him and his kind. And I'm going to tell anybody that will listen to me who I am and who my daddy is. And that I chose to be one of the outcasts because anything is better than living with the evil that lives in this house.
You think a father doesn't know what his daughter's going to do before she does it? I know I can't stop you, and I'm not a murderer, but I did invite my friend Morris over to give you a proper send-off.
Who the hell is Morris?
Morris is an artist.
His punishment on Penny is like physically violent and horrible and disfiguring.
Mm-hmm. Mutilation, it's absolutely.
Yeah, well, we'll be specific. He has her entire face tattooed, much of it with, like, the texture of, like, lizard skin.
Yeah.
Has her head shaved and her tongue forked.
Yeah.
And they just kind of say that he knew a guy who was into doing this kind of stuff, and that's enough. And then she sort of comes out of her drug state. And, like, she is transformed into a monster. And now, you know, she's got to sort of spend her life coming to terms with being a freak.
Yeah, and the scene where she comes and shows Paul for the first time when she leaves her father and she goes to Paul, it's so sad.
Yeah.
Those two are really great actors. Yeah. It's so sad.
Yeah. Considering how judgmental Penny's dad clearly is, not liking her consorting with, you know, the circus type, the friend of his who tattoos and is willing to like do all this to an unconscious. Yeah, he's hanging with some pretty low people. Friends in low places. Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a little bit odd, but
yeah, how do you know this guy that does this particular skill? I don't know. Whatever.
And is willing to do it on an unconscious girl
mm-hmm.
in the meantime. I mean, tattoo artists won't tattoo you when you're visibly drunk.
No.
So when you're incapacitated, just right all over her face. This is the worst version of the college prank where like you fall asleep first and they draw dicks
on your face. Yeah.
This is the worst version of that. but we have in this episode some father-son bonding.
Yes, we do.
I guess as the viewer, we're up to speed. We know that Del is Jimmy's dad, although he hasn't admitted it. So they go out drinking. Jimmy has way too much. Del, still, because he's, you know, a righteous asshole, is got a brick in hand and is willing to kill his son in that moment.
Yeah, he's going to do it.
Yeah.
That's really sad. He is a son of a bitch.
He's a piece of shit.
This episode, just to finish up with it, also features Jimmy singing a Nirvana song for no reason in particular.
Well, because it was his time to shine.
I guess.
With all the murder going around in the freak show, of course everybody's suspicious. And at this point, like, Elsa has shown that she's self-serving. Mm-hmm. You know, she's compassionate at different moments, but for the most part, like, there's good reason to suspect her of horrible things. And so Ethel confronts her, and Elsa is a survivor through and through.
Yes.
And she's not fucking around. If someone threatens her well-being, then it's not gonna fly. And the things that ensue in this episode are pretty grisly.
It's something, there's a specific death in this scene that I had never heard of until that scene.
The quote, suicide?
Yes, and it actually, a person in the Bronx did that maybe a year and a half ago. It was around this time, actually, that this aired. Someone actually did do that in the Bronx, and it was insanity. Like, I was like, I'd never heard of this, and then it was on TV. It was really a strange situation.
Yikes.
So I guess it is a thing that people do. I had never heard of this. We also are introduced to Ima Wiggles. Elsa finds a fat lady for the show.
I'm a Park Avenue princess. Upper East Side townhouse. We summer in Bedford. And I despise every minute of it.
So they sent you down here to reduce.
You should see Mother at Thanksgiving dinner. Every time I take a bite, she sees red. Last summer, she started telling people that I was knocked up because it was less shameful than me being a big fat pig. But I like me this way.
You are a hedonist. A lover of the physical world. But what if I told you that there is a place where every pound of that glorious jiggle will be cheered and celebrated.
Yeah, I guess there's like a long-standing tradition of the fat lady. And I watched an interview with the actress who plays her.
She's great. She's so funny. She has a great attitude. She's in a new show that's on TV. Yeah, it's going to be on in the fall. But like, she has such a great attitude about the whole thing. It's insane.
Yeah, I felt a little bad that, I guess, because her character is introduced pretty late and she's not given a whole lot to do.
No.
Yeah, I felt a little bad that, like, they could have, I don't know, given her more, because frankly, she's just kind of like a set piece.
She is. They give her a tiny, tiny backstory, and then because of shenanigans that are going on and the fact that Jimmy's not doing so well, Jimmy becomes in a relationship with her because the twins are gone.
Yeah, I think ever since the night out with his dad in the previous episode, like, he's spiraling. He starts ruining everything in his life, and it's
So I kind of was annoyed at that particular thing. Is like, he's supposed to be having this downward spiral, and he ends up with Ima Wiggles, who, I'm sorry, if you're having a downward spiral, that's not a downward spiral. She's beautiful. She's nice. She's rich. I was kind of annoyed with the way she was treated, actually, on the show, because she's like a rich, beautiful, like, woman. Like, fuck you. Like, that's not a downward spiral.
They kind of
treat
her like a set piece. That, like, you're just a cog in this machine without really.
That's the only thing that kind of, like, annoyed me about that particular situation.
And also that her character is a little, well, oblivious.
Yeah.
And that was, again, frustrating. That, a little one note, that character. And for, you know, a position where, I mean, overweight people are stereotypes to begin with. And this show wasn't doing her any favors.
I would have liked her, maybe for her to have been treated a little bit better on this show.
Yeah. So Dora, played by Patti LaBelle, her daughter, finally shows up to in-person confront Dandy.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked elements of this, and they're just so fucking crazy.
Yeah.
But Well, I guess there's not a lot we can say without giving it away, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I did think it was funny. In the same episode, Dandy, Gloria, his mom, has sent him to the therapist.
Oh, he's so annoyed.
Under the guise of testing his intelligence, because yes, they're all sure he's brilliant.
And it was so funny. The interaction between the two of them is so funny to me. The lines that they say, every single one is hilarious.
Yeah, the mom, it took me a while to sort of appreciate the oddball that she's playing.
Mm-hmm.
But Frances Conroy, I guess I've loved since 6 Feet Under, and I loved her in this, and she pops up in American Horror Story here and there.
Yeah, since the beginning.
Oh, is she in the first season?
Yeah, she's the maid. I'm always freaking telling you this. She's the maid. And then the chick from Walking Dead is also the maid. They're both the maid. Episode 9 is Tupperware Party Massacre, which leads us back to the very beginning when Jimmy has these Tupperware parties that
quote-unquote
he frequents.
Tupperware, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all a guy's. They're all getting fingered.
Exactly. Well, now, though, he's just too drunk to do that. He can't even...
He's too drunk to perform with his hands. Like that's pretty
sad.
Drunk.
That is very drunk.
I think one of the ladies says he slipped it in the wrong hole, which was like, it was a quiet aside, but I was like, ooh.
But I was kind of, honestly, I was kind of thinking that's what was going on all along.
Oh,
that's why he was so
giving the shocker
famous.
Like
yeah,
that?
Because that's the way his hands are. I don't know.
He's giving the lobster boy shocker.
That's what I had assumed was
patent
going
pending.
On all along until she says that, and you're like, oh, well, then what was he doing?
But I guess up to this point, Stanley is sort of toyed with the twins. He's a man always looking for an angle, so he's toyed with the idea, like, if they want separation, then, you know, he can falsely promise that
right.
He can have that done for them. And it was actually an error I made on last episode regarding this, that the twins, Bette and Dot, they actually have most of their own physiology. They have two hearts, two sets of organs. That said, the idea of separating them is still insane, because, like, they don't have double bodies. They don't have
no.
a place for that second head to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, where's she going?
They're just going to be literally split down the middle in
right.
half. And yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a little bit odd of a promise. I get the like want to be separate,
mm-hmm.
but even they start debating like the merits of, you know,
right.
is it worth taking the chance that one of us could die? So Dandy, he's actually, the irony is he would never get caught for any of his murders. He seems good enough at it.
Sort of, but then he also doesn't kind of care what's going like
in the house.
Yeah,
where it's kind of like his fortress, and he can
do whatever he wants.
Promise a bunch of money, and people would believe it because looking at the surroundings, he's a man of means. But like when he goes after the Tupperware party, like he very deliberately plants Jimmy's gloves,
his
very
mittens.
Distinct. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
They're mittens. Okay. So I guess he's been seen all around town. He,
yeah.
he uses them when he rides his motorcycle or to save on special effects for that day.
Smart.
But when the cops find those, that is the only clue they need to track down the freak they believe is responsible for the Tupperware Party Massacre, which is a
right.
great name.
It is a great name.
Yeah.
And we see then
Some
Jimmy in the back of the cruiser at the end of the episode.
Yeah, freaks can't catch a break.
No.
In this goddamn show.
No, you can't. Even when they're down, like Ryan Murphy just keeps kicking them. Number 10 is one of my favorite ones. It's called
yeah.
Orphans. It's basically the Pepper story. And it explains how Pepper goes from this freak show and how she gets into Asylum, which is season 2.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
so fucking sad, and I hate everything about it, but I love it at the same time, and Mare Winningham is here, and you know everyone knows how much I love Mare Winningham, and she's an evil, evil, mean bitch.
Yeah, well, so let's get specific. Pepper, and it's funny, what I complained before about the introduction of the fat lady character not being like a character with depth,
mm-hmm.
this is an episode almost entirely devoted to Pepper and her backstory.
Yeah.
And we find out that she is like the fucking keystone on which Elsa built
right.
the freak show. And, you know, Pepper is one of the pinheads who has microcephaly. And so we never really give her much of a second thought. She's almost like a child of the freak show.
Right.
But here we find out that Elsa sort of discovered her.
But I could tell that none of my teaching or attention
was going to make my firstborn happy. She was a woman now, and she had maternal needs, but she couldn't possibly be allowed to breed. Little did I know that the answer to my prayers would arrive a few weeks later from the Far East.
Then she got Ma Petite. And
right.
With Ma Petite, Pepper was fulfilled and satisfied, but still kind of longed for love. Enter Salty. And so little by little, the freak show builds with Elsa and Pepper. And I love that, until we find out that, well, very early in the episode, that Salty died of a stroke overnight.
Yes.
And she is just, like, heartbroken, utterly devastated, at which point Elsa realizes that, like, there's no replacing that. Like,
right.
There's no coming back from this.
Right. And Elsa also has goals of moving on at this point in the show.
Stanley's promise just about.
And so she
everything.
Knows, though, out of all the people, it's like she doesn't care what happens to the other people, but she cares so much what happens to Pepper.
Yeah.
So she finds a place for Pepper to live for the rest of her life. And
yeah, with her
sister.
Mayor Winningham is like really hateable.
Yeah, you
really
hate her
good.
So much. And I love Mayor Winningham, and I hate her so much in this season.
She's a woman who's made excuses for everything in her life.
Right.
And half the reason she allowed Pepper to go into the foster system was because she wanted to have a kid and start a family. And in her mind, you could not do that with a dependent already on hand. Like, what
right.
man in his right mind? And
well, you know, she just, yeah, she
like
just didn't want
the
responsibility, 40s. And she was a bitch.
Yeah,
she was
too busy drinking
mm-hmm.
On her own time. But so with Pepper around, she has a baby.
Yeah.
And that baby is most likely, like, fetal alcohol.
Right, there's something
afflicted.
Wrong with the baby. It cries all the time.
The husband is the villain from The Wedding Singer.
Yeah. There's so much in this like one episode, and Pepper wanted something to care for. And so now Mayor Winningham has this baby, and Pepper is like the best caretaker and
yeah.
completely devoted to this baby. And Mayor Winningham's in one scene bossing her around, making her get drinks and carrying the baby.
Right. Elsa makes the mistake of telling her that Pepper can mix a pretty good martini
yeah.
or like Manhattan or whatever. And that's the point where Mayor Winningham's like, I get my own personal
she is
bartender.
Hired. It's so sad, this whole episode. And I don't want to spoil it because it is a great way that it introduces how Pepper comes into the asylum.
Yeah. Yeah. Towards the end of the episode, we do get a flash forward of Pepper at the asylum
mm-hmm.
building, the sort of mental hospital that takes place in season two. And she's flipping through like Life magazines.
Yeah.
And there is Elsa like in the limelight on the cover of Life magazine as the star. She always, you know, she
yeah.
never doubt in her own mind that she would make it there. But we as the audience see it. And, you know, it gives Pepper comfort, and it's really a sweet
it's
moment.
It's so sad, though.
And it also telegraphs that, like, Elsa makes it out. Like,
yeah.
some, all right, let's see where this goes. Episode 11, Magical Thinking, introduces Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah.
Which, I like the premise of his character more than I liked his execution of it.
I
like the idea of the puppet.
I love NPH, but I didn't really care for the. Why are you introducing this new character in 11? Which I know why, because it fulfills certain plot lines that have to be fulfilled. But
yeah.
other than that, it's not my favorite thing.
I also thought it could have been way creepier. His puppet, in his mind, is a voice that he hears on the regular.
Right.
And that voice is Jamie Brewer, who we know from season one. I don't remember if she comes back. She's in season three, Coven. But she here and there, but it's a woman puppet. So to begin with, like, it's odd that Neil Patrick Harris is doing the voice of a lady puppet and still.
Right. That should be a sort of red flag of what's going on. I don't know. Whatever.
Oh, he sells lizards. Like, I don't know if they're chameleons, but it's his other like side business that he promises Elsa, like, she can have part of the profits. In the meantime, she gets a look at his books and knows that, like, hey, he really is a nerd through and through, and he's very good at the due diligence of bookkeeping. And so she brings him on with, you know, that sort of condition that
mm-hmm.
he will do the books for them and cook them if need be. So they do find out that Jimmy was arrested. He is being held for the murder of God knows how many women. And Elsa pleads with Eve and, I guess, Del to jailbreak them. This is where the story is kind of, you go along with it because it's happening, but it's kind of absurd.
This is where I think lots of people get annoyed with Ryan Murphy, because this happens in almost every season. There comes a point where it's just like, there's too much. This is too many things going on right now. And this gets crazy absurd. It's like the last season of The Wire. And you're just like, what? There's a newspaper? Like, no, this is ridiculous. And this is kind of, it hits that when you introduce Neil Patrick Harris, it's like too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah. And then this sort of convoluted, less than believable arc becomes ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But it does give me an opportunity to talk about Amazon Eve.
My name is Erica Irvin, and I play Amazon Eve, an American Horror Story freak show. The part was originally slated for man. I auditioned for the part as a guy, slicked back my hair, no makeup, flannel shirt, bound my breasts, dropped my voice, and walked in and nailed it. The story itself is taking me on my own personal journey and seeing where I personally fit in this paradigm called freak show. I've kind of lived my life in hiding. My first inkling of knowing that I was different, I was about 4 or 5. In about 2004, I came out as transgender. And my family literally wrote back and says, do not write, do not call, you're no longer welcome in our home. My father and I don't get along very well. My father was very strict. He was a high school science teacher when he retired, and I would like to, at the very least, have him see me. Make it on camera, make it on TV and film.
So Amazon Eve, played by Erica Irvin, is 6'7". I thought it was a prosthesis. Yeah. I thought she was literally walking on stilts and they were just sort of, finding sneaks in the special effects.
She is
effects.
A very tall lady.
And
I think they put her in heels, too, to make her even hot, even taller,
really funny.
I almost said even hotter. And I was like, yes, that's true. But also to make her taller.
Her character throughout the show is very, like, maternal and protective, and she's like everyone's big sister, actually. That's
right.
More
she's
of the dynamic.
The protection, I think, of everyone. And I love the scenes, the way, and I wonder how her as an actress, when she's dealing with Ma Petite, she is so, like, gentle.
Delicate, yeah.
And delicate with her, and that is what gives you that maternal kind of instinct with her.
Yeah, yeah. I like her character a lot, that she's always the one to, like, stand up for right. We haven't really talked about it, but back when Penny is affected, like, the moment she is, quote-unquote, one of us, she is under their protection, mm-hmm. and they will seek revenge.
Right.
And that scene is really emotional. It was really good, but Eve is one of those that, like, you want me to grab him? I'll grab him.
Exactly.
Like, we'll just snatch this motherfucker up and do what needs to be done. And I love her for that. Episode 12, Showstoppers, takes us right into the movie Freaks itself.
Yes.
Elsa talks about the plot and does so with Stanley at their sort of group dining table. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of celebrating that Elsa is going to be going to California. Neil Patrick Harris is going to be buying the freak show. And Elsa talks about the dynamic of, like, what it means to wrong one of the freaks.
Right.
We will enjoy Freaks. Do you know that picture, Richard?
I can't say that I do.
Oh, it's a wonderful picture.
Explain the plot to him, Eve and Paul.
Well, the film is set in a traveling circus. A freak show.
Cleopatra, a normal trapeze artist, marries the sideshow midget. But actually, she's trying to poison him for his inheritance. She plays all the freaks for fools until one day she gets drunk and reveals her true intentions.
Then the freaks turn on her. They take their revenge out at night with knives and guns.
Eve, darling, don't spoil the ending for him.
And Stanley, it starts, like, sinking in.
But it takes him too long to figure it out. Like, they're talking about you right now.
Yeah.
And he takes him quite a while.
Maybe because Maggie was also there at the table. So Lady Esmeralda, or whatever she calls herself, is sitting there at the table, and when the accusation is clear that they mm-hmm. know Stanley has been killing them.
And putting them on display.
Yeah. And Maggie jumps in. She's like, I told him everything. There's no denying it. And, you know, he sort of flails. He's kind of a scumbag. And without giving it away, the premise of the movie Freaks factors in directly to the repercussions that follow. And it's jarring. It's a disturbing visual, Stanley's fate. But for that, like, the viewer really owes it to themselves to watch the movie Freaks. Yes. Because some of the visuals specifically, like the idea that, you know, you kind of turn around and all the freaks are armed and they're not breaking eye contact with you, like, you're fucked.
You definitely are. And I think in some ways Ryan Murphy shows a little bit more than what Todd Browning had cut out of Freaks. Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, if Todd Browning had watched it, he would have been like, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to show that.
I guess we're not going to talk too much about the last episode, Curtain mm-hmm. Call, because it is kind of an epilogue to the season. Yep. And so it really is giving the whole show away. But I have mixed feelings about who lives, who dies, the, like, full extent and repercussions of the story. I don't know. How'd you feel about the end?
Well, you know, I like an ending where maybe everyone dies or something like that. So there's certain things that are just happy endings that just knowing what happened to real life freaks from freak shows, like, yeah. It kind of sugarcoats it, makes it kind of very nice and everyone's accepting and all these things. And that kind of, I don't like that happy ending because it's not true.
Yeah. Well, it's a very selective happy ending. Mm-hmm. I think across the board, most people get a raw deal. But yeah, I don't know. We sort of come back to David Bowie being sung on primetime television by Elsa. You know, you're going to have your favorite episodes, but it's worth a watch, I think.
Right, right. I'm not looking forward to the next time we talk about American Horror Story.
Oh, we're going to have to figure out something fun to do with Coven, to make Coven fun.
As soon as someone tells me, like, oh, I watch American Horror Story, I loved Coven, then I, like, side-eye them like a maniac.
My eyebrow goes up, yeah. So that'll wrap it up for this two-part series on American Horror Story Season 4, Freak Show. And join us on social media.
Yeah.
It's important to mention we are on Patreon. As of today, we have ordered stickers, buttons, and magnets as merch. And on Patreon, you also get exclusive content. So far, we've got a fully produced episode that's a Night of the Living Dead retrospective. Mm-hmm. And I also put up the bonus track from my album, Apophenia. It's on Fangoria, but the best song on the album is for those at Patreon as a subscriber and Patreon supporter. We're on all the social media. Find us, give us a review on iTunes. It goes a long way.
Yeah, it's bumping us up on the thing.
Spread the word. Stickers will go a long way for that too, I think. I don't know.
I don't know. I'll put them wherever I can put them. So follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Check us out on Instagram. We're trying to do more on Instagram, but it's a weird place for a podcast, right?
Yeah. We're trying to, we put up videos on the regular. Murphy makes regular appearances on our Instagram. We've got a curated series of Murphy, the jaded horror fan.
Out of the Rance Macabre, Murphy's the most interesting host.
Oh, yeah. We put up our videos that are accompanying the home invasion episode. So those are on our YouTube page. And you'll find links to all these things on Facebook and Twitter. You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.